Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here, sitting across from me is my beloved co-host.
He is here. Mike Cosentino is here, as is Gary LeMaster. The terrible trio is here again to try to make some sense out of
terrorism.
Terrorism.
We talked about torture last week. And then today's cheery topic is terrorism and the overreaction to terrorism.
Yeah.
Because torture, the American torture program is in a lot of ways an overreaction to 9/11. It was not occurring before 9/11. George Bush signed some findings and some orders within 6 days after 9/11 that led to the war against Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. And what evolved in that whole process was a process of torture. So what is terrorism? And I was going to one of my favorite sources, which is, I believe it's Wikipedia, said that there are 100, they found 100 different definitions of terrorism. I'll give you the most common one. My little variation on it is terrorism is commonly defined as violent acts or believable threat of violent acts intended to create fear or terror. They're used for religious, political, and ideological reasons, for goals, to try to keep goals. And they're either deliberately aimed at noncombatants, civilians, or they're aimed in such a way as to disregard civilian casualties. So when the Al Qaeda attacks the World Trade Center, we see it as a massive attack on thousands of civilians. They could say, "Well, we were just trying to knock down the buildings." But if you attack a building that's filled with people, you're a terrorist, and because you're really attacking people at the same time.
Well, there's state terrorism and there's non-state terrorism.
Exactly.
We're talking about that too, and it's the non-state one that's scaring the crap out of everybody right now. Because how do you defend against somebody that walks into a department store or supermarket in Australia or in Arizona, and who's never been in contact with Al-Qaeda or Boko Haram or whatever, and yet has adopted the philosophy somehow?
So I think a lot of what people see is a reaction to 9/11, and I think even the NSA spies. Before 9/11, the NSA is basically spying on other governments and leaders and political people it knows. The attack on the United States come from people that they don't really know much about. They don't know where they are. They have very little information on it. So they radically expand the NSA program, and they have a problem because, if you're targeting governments or high officials or NGOs or something, you have a visible target that you can look for the invisible part of. But if you're just what they don't do is they don't stop. They need data. They don't have good data on all these different groups. And so they collect data on us and everybody else and have huge storage facilities, because if they don't store the data, then they can't trace back a terrorist movement. Torture, again, that we talked about last week, a kind of, I believe, overreaction to 9/11.
Great article in the New York Times, December 16th, that said the CIA had no idea what to do after 9/11. They were panicked. And so torture came out of that, and as ineffective as it was, they whether they knew it was ineffective or but it didn't matter. They had no tools in their bag after 9/11, and they were desperate for something.
I think that's exactly true. I think people were totally confused. They did not know what to do. You have to go back to 9/11. No one expected it. It was a tremendous emotional, psychological shock to the American people. I was one of the people who was standing down four blocks north of the World Trade Center when the first tower went down. And for something that didn't happen to me, I jumped into a doorway when all this debris came towards us. For something that didn't happen to me or injuring me, it was the most horrific thing I ever saw in my life. I've seen terrible traffic accidents and so forth and so on. But this was the most horrible event I had ever seen. And it sent a shock through the American people and a call to get something done. And I believe, and I don't know what Mike and Gary think, we had very weak leadership then. I don't think that George Bush may be a nice man, but I don't think he understood who was working for him or anything else. I think he just thought these were smart guys who knew what they were doing, Gary.
His initial plan was to be somewhat isolationist. He didn't want to get involved in the Middle East other than to take oil. But to say that it wasn't expected, we had an attack on the World Trade Center with bombs in the underground parking that ended up being just a few hundred pounds shy of explosives that would have toppled the towers back, you know,
2003.
It shouldn't have come as a great surprise to anyone. It had been attempted before, and then there were many warnings prior to 9/11 that there were potential attacks involving civilian planes,
I don't think people realize that the amount of damage a terrorist group could do, even though they had attacked a coal. A destroyer, even though they'd blown up an embassy. So, Clinton had retaliated against them.
And if you remember right, Bush referred to that in the election as, in the run up to the 2000 election, as sending $1 million missile to blow up a camel tent. So it was kind of dismissed by the administration very early on.
What is terrorism to you, Mike? To me, the big debate, and let me just say, what do you think about a lot of people, the definition of terrorism does not include anything a state does.
Well, I'm sorry. My issue today is that the definition of terrorism has to include right-wing terrorists. Prior to 9/11, the biggest terrorist attack in this country was Timothy McVeigh, 168 people. In Europe, prior to Charlie Hebdo and the London bombings, it was the Oslo killings where some white guy killed 77 people. We forget those because they weren't Islam-inspired, I guess.
And given the fact that today is Martin Luther King Day, we can't ignore the fact that racism is a terrorist tactic in itself. It's terrorism.
That is, well, I walked in with the quote this morning that Osama bin Laden's dream of bankrupting the West has just as much chance of at least as I measure it in January 2015, is being at least as successful as Martin Luther King's dream of some sort of that the United States will actually put into practice what it's been saying for 220 years, that somehow we are equal.
I have to check the figures, Mike, but the figures I saw was that before 9/11, the activities that we now are gathered in the Homeland Security, Department of Homeland Security, they spent $17 billion on. We're not talking about the military action or the wars.
Right.
In 2011, they spent $69 billion on it. And now how much is spent on it? $100 billion a year on Homeland Security, and this is aside from military.
Well, that's it. I'm sure somebody has calculated it.
It's the second largest department of the federal government after the military. And, you know, it's odd to me that they separate the Homeland Security and the military budget says, I mean, to me, they're, you know, if you look at other nations' budgets for the military, they include both of those items.
They also separate out Veteran Affairs,
right,
so that the real cost of the wars and stuff is not really visible in just the amount of military spending that you see. I wanted to ask you guys what you thought. And there's the old phrase, one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist.
Right.
And we have some examples of it. The Malaysian guerrillas fought with the British against the Japanese occupation of Malaysia. Then they were heroes and freedom fighters and so forth and so on. The British decide to stay in Malaysia, and the Malaysians didn't want them there. And the freedom fighters suddenly became terrorists. Ronald Reagan referred to the Afghan Mujahideen, which is like fighters, as freedom fighters when they were fighting the Russians. The right. same guys, basically, when we move into there and attack us, are called terrorists. So what's going on with this?
It's the same thing in, you know, Indonesia. We supported a very repressive government in Indonesia. The East Timor, you know, people were fighting for freedom from Indonesia, and we considered them terrorists, even though they were fighting for the same kind of goals that we, you know, espouse.
So is terrorism is what I call a weaponized definition. You use it against people that you don't like. But underneath, there is, I think, something called terrorism, which is the use of violence and killing to intimidate, right? And aren't you, Gary, trying to get, you know, in 9/11, you kill a few thousand people, but aren't you trying to intimidate hundreds of thousands of Americans? Aren't you trying to affect, same way in France, you're killing a bunch of writers publicly, and aren't you trying to intimidate France? You're trying to do something way beyond. How does that work?
It's simply a, you know, terrorism is simply a tactic to influence behavior. And I'd like to point out that the media are part and parcel to it. When the media blows something out of proportion, for example, in the same week, almost to the day that the 17 people were killed in Paris, more than 2,000 villagers were killed in Nigeria by Boko Haram,
right.
which is another Islamic terrorist group. And our media barely paid any attention to it.
Yeah.
You could find it, you know, somewhere if you dug around into the various websites and to the newspapers. But it wasn't a huge thing. There was no gathering of world leaders. There was no march. There was no
sympathy.
And you're
saying because it wasn't a Western country.
I think it's because they look different than us.
I see.
I think it's simply, I mean, it's MLK
fine.
Day. It's
yeah.
I think it's an important distinction.
Yeah, yeah.
These are black people that died. And,
right.
And it's in a continent that we don't much care about. And,
well,
and
it's,
yet,
it's also yet, in a country that seems unable to even fight them.
Yeah.
It's in a country so disorganized and so corrupt that the military is unable to fight the terrorists.
You could use that same description throughout much of the world.
I know. I would agree with you.
I'm just going to share this in Foreign Policy magazine. A guy named Joshua Keating had reported on a study they did in Pakistan. In other words, we're talking about sources of terrorism. We're talking about overreactions or reactions to terrorism, whether it's over or not. And there's articles and there's lots of common thought that poverty breeds terrorism. That there's two things that breed terrorism: American policy, and we can talk about that in a minute. And the other thing is poverty. That when they have, you know, televisions and Jiffy Pop, as far as I'm concerned, pirates' booty. If we just spread that product around the world, everybody would be much happier. But the study that they talked to 6,000 Pakistanis, and what they found is what I think you would find in the United States, that lower income and middle income people don't support terror, don't support militants of any stripe, that it's often middle class and above that are terrorist supporters. So what the survey concluded, unfortunately, said depressingly that the only response, the only thing that the only way to reduce terrorism is more terrorism. The only thing that they find, it's not saying beef up jobs and whatnot in the lower classes, and you as terrorist breeding grounds. That's not where they're coming from.
at least in, you know, in former colonies, yes, there's tremendous anger among the people who actually run the country. And if you pick one country that is most violently any American country in the world, it's Pakistan. So terrorism is the use of violence. And a lot of times I think, folks, that it's aimed at provoking not just a reaction, but an overreaction. The damage that the terrorists do with a particular act, killing 17 people, if they can intimidate the French and force the French not to allow ridicule of Islam, they've done something far beyond the 17 people that they've killed. If the World Trade Centers, I don't know how to do the blame on the World Trade Centers, because of what I've been reading recently, early reporters who broke the story of all the secret prisons and stuff. And I guess there was chaos in the American government. People, like Mike alluded to earlier, really didn't know what to do. The CIA didn't know what to do. The military didn't know what to do. State Department didn't know what to do. They were running around, and they couldn't hire enough employees, so they hired hundreds of thousands of contractors. And so you see the guys we were talking last week, the guys who provided, two psychologists who provided the information on how to torture people or help design the program, were paid $81 million.
Right.
And I think that's the general way things have been done.
There's lots of articles now about controlling the contractor. Well, not now, but certainly now and in the recent past, about controlling the contractors, and that they often operate without oversight, without much oversight, without enough oversight.
If after 9/11, we started awarding, the Bush administration started awarding contracts to companies that were non-bid, no-bid contracts. So we just threw money at a problem, not even knowing for sure what the problem was.
We want to give a shout out to the conspiracy theorists out there, of which I work with a couple, that it was all just a plot to get George Bush reelected, and it worked very well.
I don't believe
no,
that.
No,
I don't buy that either.
I just want to, that truther stuff is
a left-wing version of the vast conspiracy theories that you see.
I do want to quote a lady from Cindy Storer. I hope I pronounced her name right, from CNN. We're talking about, once again, sources and reactions to terrorism. She says, and this is once again not a revelation, you don't need a PhD in foreign policy, but she says that terrorism ends when terrorists have no audience and no new recruits. They become marginalized is when terrorism will, and she says. That happens when the people whose needs they claim to represent are themselves no longer marginalized. That's one of the things about having the world leaders in Paris. Progress was made in building relationships. Today, as I was driving in, I'm listening to the European Union talking about including Islamic states in the European, for want of a better term, it's a media thing, war on terror.
It's hard to have a war against a tactic.
Well, that's it.
that's the other thing, folks, is that George Bush called it a war on terror.
Yeah.
But terror is a tactic. It's using violence to intimidate people. It's usually asymmetrical.
Yeah.
Al-Qaeda is a really tiny little group. It's able to do horrific damage. But there was never part of it is American action, that there was never another attack. Part of it is that Al-Qaeda is a tiny little group. There are at least, the count I saw, more than almost 3,000 American governmental organizations and private contractors involved in fighting terrorism.
Wow.
And
they're centered
around the NSA facility in Virginia.
Yeah.
They have their offices around there. But it's produced a huge business. And you'll see some of these guys coming on, you know, particularly Fox News, that's got some of the most corrupt and crazy terrorists. But you can make a living out of this now. It's hundreds of millions and millions of dollars.
For yourselves.
And it's, as Mike and Gary say, it's pretty much unregulated, and there's nobody going through and seeing whether these guys know anything. And so we have really anti-Islam people training the police, telling them all kinds of nonsense. They're not vetted, it seems to me, in any way. They're just paid. And the problem is that there's an anti-terrorism industry now, a huge industry.
And I think one of the, I'm a critic of the media, it's kind of a theme of mine, but I think it's one of the big issues with terrorism is that the media actually participates. Not long ago, just after the Paris attacks, Sean Hannity made some outrageous claims. He claimed that Muslims are overwhelming Europe, that they hate their host countries, that the Muslim neighborhoods are too dangerous for police or fire, that Muslim neighborhoods have invoked Sharia law, and that European hotels now have copies of the Quran and prayer rugs available in every room. And, there was on one of my favorite news shows, Fareed Zakaria on CNN yesterday, he had an author and a former international affairs columnist for the Globe and Mail who took those claims one by one and tore them apart and found out that Muslims have never comprised, well, in Europe, they comprise 2.5 to 7.5% of the population, and they will never exceed 10%. And they will never be the majority or even the largest minority. They tend to be among the most patriotic members of their new countries. There are some that are extremely angry and have been, disaffected, but that's a very
so
small
France
minority.
Has, France has a five has the largest Muslim population in Europe.
7.5%.
Yeah, and it's about 5 million people. It has 500,000 Jews, and of course we have the whole Middle East conflict going on. So, and also in France and in Europe, the United States, I know that there's all this anti-immigrant stuff now, but the United States was built on absorbing different immigrants with different ideas. It starts very early. I mean, we've talked about this before, the English didn't like the Scotch Irish. They didn't like the way they acted. They didn't like the way they cooked food. They didn't like anything. And that continues through American history, and we sort of worked at it. In Europe, there's a very strong, so even if you're Sweden, it's an extraordinarily liberal place, it's ethically pretty much one country until you get immigrants from all around the world. And so it's much harder, or I think it's quite a bit harder to integrate people into France or Sweden or Germany than it is to the United States. When I worked with a bunch of Muslim guys, I happened to be working with them at a time where they were all becoming citizens of the U.S. and trying to find a way being citizen. So I think we do a better job of integrating minorities in the United States. It's far from perfect, as Gary will tell you, but that's a lot of the problem in Europe. And immigration is difficult to deal with, and it sets off far right wing groups. So far, most of them haven't gone to terrorism, although the fellow you were talking about in Sweden who killed all those people was an anti-immigrant, anti-secularist.
Norway. I think you have to keep in mind most of the Muslim immigrants in Europe and elsewhere are refugees. They are the result of being driven out of their homelands by war. Violence.
And they're mostly from colonies. They're mostly the French Jewish population and the French Muslim population are all from mostly the largest positions are from former French colonies, and the Muslim population is ghettoized in suburbs of the major city. They don't have much prospect. But the thing about terrorism is I really think that we have to focus on what it's aimed to achieve. And so is it terrorism? One person, I'm going to rob a bank and I shoot some guys to terrorize people before I take all the money from the bank. That's not terrorism. Terrorism has a political, religious, has some sort of an agenda, right?
Yeah.
And that's one difference. It's usually organized by groups or small groups of people, and it's aimed at achieving political results. And often those political results, whether you trying to get an overreaction out of your enemy.
Well, that's it, and they've been wildly successful. I'm quoting Salar Aziz. She's a professor at Texas A&M. But she says the Al-Qaeda playbook since 9/11 has been to provoke Western powers into doing things they otherwise wouldn't. And some people say dragging us into somebody else's civil war.
Absolutely.
The Iraq war, Abu Ghraib was a godsend to Al-Qaeda for recruitment, a godsend to ISIS. By us overreacting with things like that happened at Abu Ghraib, with going to war in Iraq, she says, by dangerously overreacting and overreaching, we fell into a trap, and we will likely fall into another trap and another trap and another trap after that. Europe's far right, which was also was already surging in France and in Germany, now is going to get more recruits.
I'm trying to think about some things. There's the overreaction by a government to a terrorist act. In that you have torture, you have this vast expansion of the military, you have the billions of dollars spent just getting in airports. And then there's the use of the state to do things that they wanted to do before, using terrorism as an excuse, and that's the war in Iraq. Exactly, that's a war in Iraq. The neoconservatives surrounding Bush, and I don't think that President Bush even knew who they were or what their agenda was. I think he thought they were just the BART guys who had some ideas. They had long wanted to have a war with Iraq.
It was part of Cheney's plan for a new American century, which he wrote in the early 90s. That, you know, part of that plan included invading Iraq, overthrowing Saddam, and building, you know, using that as a platform for military in the Middle East.
Right. So there's the overreaction, which is one thing. It's better. People are complaining about President Obama. It is always better to have a steady plan, think things through, decide carefully, like in Afghanistan. I have no problem with going in and going after Osama bin Laden and his terrorists there. But we ended up being in there, what is it, 13, 14 years now, Gary, trying to rebuild the country in the way we would like it.
Much longer, actually. We've been – one of the interesting things that's never talked about with Afghanistan and Pakistan is that when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan – we had Charlie Wilson's war, where we gave Stinger missiles and all sorts of weapons to Islamic groups to fight back against the Western infidels, the Soviets. One of the fascinating things was a propaganda portion of that war was, you know, we printed the dean of the international studies at University of Nebraska, Omaha, wrote a number of textbooks for school children in Pakistan that, you know, taught them to count by counting dead Soviet bodies and Kalashnikov rifles and tanks and so on. And we printed those and distributed them throughout Western Pakistan. Those books are still being used today, you know, in the madrasas, the most extreme Muslim madrasas or schools in Western Pakistan, and it's contributed greatly to some of this extremism.
The United States tried to play the religious card against the Soviets. I mean, the Afghan government was secular and communist, or at least they said they were communist. And they did a lot of things like limiting the amount of land somebody could have, improving the rights of women. And they did a lot of positive things, as well as a lot of really, really negative things. The United States did everything it could, right, and it sort of unscrupulously to get rid of them. And if it meant empowering the most reactionary conservative forces in Afghan society, that's what they did.
It's the whole thing about the notion that the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Right.
You know, that was the basis of the Cold War and is still haunting us today.
So the question is, Charlie Hebdo, will France, will Europe, how are they overreacting? 9/11 and the other threats in the last 13, 14 years, how has the U.S. overreacted? Other than that, we're talking about tens, hundreds of billions of dollars.
Right.
You know, when I see them cuts, wanting to cut Social Security, when I see the horrific, I'm sorry, there's no other word for the education system in the United States except horrific.
It's poured into all these things. I the way I see it is, there's the shock and a reaction. The actual reaction, the confusion, trying to figure out what you're doing. In the case of 9/11 in the United States, we had extraordinarily bad, incompetent leadership. And so there's the initial response, which you know, I understand people are running around. I mean, when I was in New York City, I would jog around the reservoir in Manhattan. There would be guys in black SUVs with machine guns. There were guys with machine guns in all the subways. There's all this, if you knew people who were involved in the thing, there's all kinds of secrets there. And that's the immediate overreaction. You know, they blow us up. We put guns, guys with guns. Nothing ever happened. They were never used. The other thing is the incompetent and terrible and extreme policies that follow on year after year. And I would criticize President Obama.
He
stopped torture. He stopped the prisons, the hidden prisons. But as somebody said, he really didn't do much else to curb the NSA or the CIA.
The drones are creating more terrorists.
The drones are top of the list, by the way, of the list you just gave. The drones are at the top of the list.
So I wanted to talk about, guys, in our remaining time, see what you think about this. And one of the things I wanted to do is, because we were a little talking about the definition of terrorism, and I've always not been sure the people that we call eco-terrorist or eco-terrorists were really terrorists, because they seem to be aimed their burnings and bombings at property rather than at people. And I see terrorism as being aimed at killing and injuring people,
creating fear.
Now, nobody agrees with me that they're not terrorists, because if they blow up a laboratory that's working, experimenting on animals, somebody, even if they blow it up at night when they think there's nobody there, the janitor could be there, somebody could be killed anyway. So on that basis, they're terrorists. What do you think, Gary?
It has a big impact. I had my office, firebombed back in the 80s, and no one was injured, no one was killed, but you know, the impact of that was frightening, and it was devastating to all of us that worked there. I'd like to point out one thing too about going back to Charlie Hebdo, that one thing that's not talked about, you know, all the sensationalism, all the fear, you know, promoted by the media, and you continually hear the media and all of these people like Hannity call for Muslims to, you know, leaders to speak out and denounce the terrorist acts. Well, the fact is they have. Immediately after the attacks at Charlie Hebdo in Paris, the primary Islamic group in Europe and the largest Islamic group in the U.S. both forcefully spoke out, issued statements denouncing the attacks, and yet the media never reported it. And continue, over the weekend, I heard the same crap again. They continue to say, well, these people need to speak out. They haven't done so yet. And it's
so how much of our reaction is controlled by media reaction? So if today's show is examining, reactions and overreactions, obviously we gotta react somehow.
Well, think of an example, Mike. We talked about, 2 weeks ago, Ebola. Now, it's not even being done by a person. It's just a kind of plague. It's just an epidemic. And before the election, there are 700-800 stories about it. After election, there are 50 stories.
Exactly.
I think a lot of it is driven by desire for ratings. As we talked about then, CNN did more stories on it than Fox News did. Those were the two people pushing the Ebola story, two media outlets.
Well, they're our biggest news sources.
Yeah. So I think they have a tremendous role.
Well,
there's tremendous push now to make the president do extreme things. They tried to push us into the war in Syria. He's not running the country the way the neoconservatives and the Beltway guys would like, because he doesn't react and do the kinds of things. But George Bush, and I like George Bush, I think, as a person, was a very, very weak leader, because he didn't know what he was doing. And he was available then for people in the United States government who had different agendas. Why did we go to a war in Iraq? Ask yourself that. They had absolutely nothing. Where did the phony intelligence completely undercut that Al-Qaeda had some relationship with Saddam Hussein?
Yeah.
It was ridiculous from day one.
Exactly. And I don't think, like what you're doing now, is we can't let it go. You know, that we went to war on a lie, that we fought in the wrong place, you know, that we, people still, to this day, over 50% of Americans believe there's a connection between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. Regardless of truth.
We had 2 years of propaganda telling them that.
Well, and I guess, I know we're getting toward the end. I want to quote another guy, Shadi Hamid. He works as a research fellow at the New American Foundation. But we're talking about hope. Where do we go from here? And he doesn't have a great message, by the way. I mean, he said, in other words, what he's looking for is, he's looking for consensus in the American media, or consensus in the American people. Say, okay, you know, either, except for a few liberals, you know, sitting around this table, he doesn't see a lot of kumbaya or brotherhood or that. And he says one reason you don't see a lot of brotherhood, because there isn't that an American Muslim or a European Muslim that witnesses blasphemy may or may not be okay with it. There's no consensus there. There's no consensus in the Western reaction to it, whether it's Europe or America. So as long as there's no consensus on the Muslim side, we're just going to let free speech do its thing and we'll be okay. And there's no consensus in reacting to, when people get angry about blasphemy, which apparently in some religions is a killing offense.
There's a differential.
Or should we all be Bill Maher?
It's asymmetrical
and religion
amount of power.
Is, you know,
in France, you have, a very weak but very, very large Muslim population living on the bottom of the French economy. So when you attack their religion, it feels like more than just attack on a religion. It feels like the big guys with all the power attacking little guys.
Well, that's a good point.
And see, there is a dimension of that to the Charlie Hebdo thing.
You're absolutely right.
Those guys are beating up on Muslims. Muslims in the magazine are always drawn with huge noses. Africans are drawn with huge lips. There are problems with the magazine.
In the
United States is more consistent about free speech than the French are, you know.
French would not allow the same kinds of cartoons and attacks on other groups.
No, they wouldn't. They've arrested a guy, a comic, because of who is anti-Semitic, for making anti-Semitic remarks. So the France has a really contradictory ideas about free speech, that I think the United States is cleaner, because we have it in our Constitution and we have to fight about it every generation. But we have a belief that free speech is pretty close to being absolute. You can't, what's the old phrase? You can't yell fire in a crowded theater, but pretty much else you can do things. It's illegal in France to deny the Holocaust. Why somebody would be that stupid, I don't know. But it is illegal. They put you in jail if you do that. So we have a more absolute idea of free speech, certainly than the French.
Here we just have the PC police.
Yes, we have the PC police.
So what I'm hearing from what our research before the show today, that we are doomed to react and overreact to every terrorist act until we address the root causes of terrorism.
That's right.
Once again, going back to, and we know what they are. And we're not just talking about giving money to poor people in the Middle East. I mean, that's not the root cause.
Let me read this, Mike, and you respond to it. Here's the responses to what they call passive terrorism. In other words, we're in Pakistan and we're funding terrorists to attack India, but we're not doing it exactly ourselves. Targeted laws, criminal procedures, deportations, enhanced police powers. That's one response. Target hardening. We see that in the airports, such as locking the doors, adding traffic barriers, preemptive or reactive military action. And down, let's see, increase intelligence and surveillance activities. We've seen all those. But down here in number five is preemptive humanitarian activities. Isn't that what you're talking about?
Yes, I'm going back to the lady from Texas A&M, Sahar Aziz, and I'm going to read the quote. So when French governments meet with officials from the U.S. and the U.K., Germany, and other Western countries to discuss how to better cooperate on combating terrorism, they'd be well advised to focus on causes rather than symptoms. Resources are better spent on assisting indigenous reformers, those people that are looking for change in Turkey and Egypt, Iran and Iraq, and whether secular or Islamist. Now, that's the other thing. We have a problem supporting Islamist reformers, I think, in their efforts to create more, now she gets a little vague here, more political space for freedom of speech, association and expression. And those are things, you know, there's a reason we have this Bill of Rights. It's not just freedom of speech. It's freedom of association and it's freedom of expression, whether it be artistic or verbal.
So what you're saying is that economics play into it. There was a story I saw this morning that by 2016, next year,
wow,
1% of the population, of the world population, will control 50% of the world's wealth.
Yeah. Let me read it.
So we're going back
to the inequality.
That was three shows ago, but you're right. It's all connected.
In fighting terrorism, what we have to remember, this is a quote from Derek Jensen, who's a radical but nonviolent environmentalist. Civilization is based on a clearly defined and widely accepted, yet often unarticulated hierarchy. Violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is nearly always invisible, that is, unnoticed. When it is noticed, it is fully rationalized. Violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is unthinkable, and when it does occur, is regarded with shock, horror, and a fetishism of the victims. That's what you want to avoid in the fight against terrorism and against violence in the world, is not understanding that there is that aspect of things hiding under there, right, Gary?
And we could take away some of another tactic that we could use is to take away some of the funding. Reza Aslan pointed out recently that the Saudis have spent $100 billion supporting an extreme form of Islamic, you know, studies, Wahhabi or Salafi Islam. And then important thing is ivory. We're losing our elephants for the ivory to help support terrorism.
Terrorists have to have funding. You know, ISIS has its oil wells and stuff. Listen to us again next week. You can hear this podcast and all our other podcasts for the last 3 years on VVID.org.
We're coming up on our anniversary. Like I said, it'd be 4 years.
Yeah, in April, yeah.
Yeah.
4 years, my gosh.
Yeah.
Nobody thought we would survive. Well, let's wrap it up by saying goodbye. Tune in to us next week, folks.
VVID,
we've got an interesting program.
VVID.org, Democratic Perspective. You can find us there. You can link to us. Please link to us, as a matter of fact. Goodbye. Oh, what are we doing next week?
We don't know what we're doing.
All right. No, Michael Austin's coming up. Another interview. It's going to be a good one.
We're going to do a program on the...
That.
You've You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.